BizNews Power Hour.
Welcome to the BizNews Power Hour. I'm Michael Apple. It's Monday, the 28th of February. The team is in the Drakensberg this week for the BizNews Conference, or as we call it, BNC3. We're going to be providing you with a wide variety of interviews and perspectives, coupled, of course, with all the international business news you need to know from our partner, the Financial Times. Let's get to your news headlines.
BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
The South African government is attempting to patch up relations with Russia following the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Naledi Pandor's call for Russia to withdraw from Ukraine. President Cyril Ramaphosa was reportedly caught off guard and is unhappy with Pandor's statement as he felt it contradicted South Africa's official stance, which is to remain neutral and call for mediation. Other members of the BRICS bloc, an associate of five major emerging economies, have refrained from criticizing Putin's invasion. SARS Commissioner Edward Kiswetter says that the Revenue Service's new unit for the super wealthy is not there to go after wealthy taxpayers, but that it was established to provide clarity on the tax obligations imposed upon this demographic, to ease compliance and assist them in their tax affairs with minimal fuss. The unit's focus is on assessing the nature of income within this demographic, any offshore or onshore financial arrangements, and the legal structures of ownership that their wealth is tied up in. The South African Medico-Legal Association, which represents medical and legal practitioners, as well as leading healthcare organizations, has urged the government to review the law surrounding culpable homicide and its application in healthcare settings. The healthcare organizations argued that the current law has a low threshold of criminal culpability and that even if a healthcare practitioner acts in good faith or commits a slight error of judgment, the prosecution can easily formulate charges and secure a criminal conviction. And now it's on to my colleague Justin for the market report.
The JSE All Share Index was up strongly at 75,700. In the price action, it's been a flight to safety, gold miners and all commodity counters well up. Harmony, Sibanye, Anglos, all around 10% up on the day. As with Friday, the same theme continues. Any companies with exposure to Russia and Ukraine, namely Mondi and Barloworld, are strongly down for the day. In the currency markets, the rand is weaker against all the major currencies to 15 rand 46 cents to the dollar, 20 rand 73 cents to the pound, and 17 rand 30 cents to the euro. Gold is up at $1,910 an ounce. Kruger Rand will cost you approximately 31,000 Rand. Brent crude is trading at $100.70 a barrel. And the premier cryptocurrency will put you back a shade under 600,000 Rand. In the financial news, Bidvest, whose interest span arranged from cleaning services to vehicles and freight management, says it is seeing South Africa's economy returning to normality, with trading profit jumping almost a quarter in the 6 months to end December. The group is optimistic that demand and economic recovery is gathering momentum, reporting a 13% rise in revenue to 50 billion rand to end December, with its freight business boosted by record maize exports. Trading profits grew by 25% to 5.1 billion, with Bidvest upping its interim dividend 30% to 3 rand 80 per share, about 100 billion rand payout to shareholders.
Well, as we all know, Russia has invaded Ukraine, and we live at the southern tip of Africa wondering what effect that has on us. Is it our war? And to help us unpack that is Chris Van Dome. He's a research fellow at the Africa Program at the esteemed Chatham House. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Linda. Good to see you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, so before we dive into what it means for South Africa, this seems to be quite dire when you look at it from a European point of view. I've read this morning assessments that say this is the end of peace in Europe. Is that reading too much in it? Is it that bad? Is this the end of the era that we had, the peaceful era we had after the Second World War?
I think in those terms, what we're seeing in that kind of language is referring to really the end of the kind of norms-based international system where there's a respect for geographically defined boundaries of nation states and the states that have emerged and participated in, you know, the United Nations and the European Union, for example, during that time. So when you talk about the kind of the largest kind of breach of that system since the Second World War, it's kind of referring to that of, you know, here is a nation state that has been invaded by another nation state against the accepted norms and systems of the UN.
What does this mean for Africa and specifically for South Africa? Because we are part of BRICS as well.
Well, exactly. I think that there's three tiers of impact on South Africa and three kind of tiers of where South African decision makers have to place the emphasis right now. And the first of those is the immediate response, which is about South African citizens who were directly caught up in what's been going on. The ambassador on the ground there, Andre Grunwald, has been quite active in communicating their response. There are a number of South African students, for example, who were on the ground, particularly in the medical sciences. So there's a number of kind of doctors being trained in Ukraine. And so that's clearly a priority, is making sure that the security and safety of South Africans that are caught up in this are, you know, that is prioritized. And beyond that, he's also been talking about the fact that, you know, other African countries don't have diplomatic or consular presence on the ground. And so some of that is being done by the South Africans as well. And they're kind of taking a wider responsibility for other Africans who are caught up in what's been going on. So that's the immediate kind of the first tier. The second tier is then the kind of the midterm, you know, how does it affect South Africa in terms of kind of very practical or economic ways? And that's where you see kind of high volatility in the markets. So you've seen oil and gas prices go up. Clearly, that's going to have an impact on global energy supplies and global inputs as well. So that's going to have an impact on kind of food prices globally. You've also got the impact of, you know, when these high risk events occur, the capital tends to migrate back to secure locations and places that are perhaps perceived as high risk, such as South Africa. You'll see a withdrawal of capital from places like this, which is why you see a slight depreciation of the rand as well. So there's going to be volatility there. And then food prices going forward, because of things like, you know, in the mid to long term, Ukraine is a significant grain producer, for example. So, you know, there's that level of impact as well, which is, you know, the global economic impact of what's going on, from which South Africa clearly isn't shielded. And then the top kind of high level geopolitical impact is exactly as you say, it's this question mark of things like BRICS. You know, how does South Africa square its membership of BRICS with this issue that a member of that organization or that cluster has done something like this? And how does that relate to, say, you know, the African Union's position on non-interventionism? I think South Africa and other African countries have, you know, been widely respecting the speech that was given by the Kenyans at the UN this week, kind of forcefully saying, we in Africa are the product of colonialism and invasion and occupancy, and we do not stand for it. And so, you know, the Kenyans were the first to come out and say that, and now you've had a statement from South Africa, perhaps a little bit softer, but saying the same things. There's that, and I think that for a number of African countries, and South Africa included, as some of the kind of larger world powers have kind of adjusted for in a kind of changing international system where, you know, since the Cold War, you've had a period of kind of American hegemony or kind of global multilateralism and, you know, multiple kind of sources of kind of dominant powers. As these things are shifting, South Africa and other African countries have sought to balance some of these relationships. But when something like this happens and it creates such a divide within, you know, again, within the United Nations and within those kind of systems of international governance, you know, it's going to start forcing the hand of places like South Africa to really take a stand on some of these issues. And it's going to mean that South African leadership have to take a position. And you can start to see that already with the way in which Cyril Ramaphosa has been talking about, you know, engaging with the Russians and the Americans. And as you say, and I'm sure as we'll discuss, you know, that then raises questions back in South Africa of, well, why are we getting involved when we've got so much at stake at home?
People on social media, the trend seems to be, this is not our war. You know, we should get involved, which is quite interesting. And it's also, Derco seems to have escalated their response. It started off quite muted, and now they're urging the Russians to withdraw. But I think they're going for the angle of, we always negotiate. We are a country born from negotiations. Let's negotiate. So any role for South Africa in that, trying to do that?
Yeah, look, you know, that refers to two things, I think. Number one is that, yes, South Africa had for a long time, and it waned under Zuma, but, you know, certainly in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, the process that South Africa went through in kind of forging what happened in the kind of creation of the constitution, moved to democratic participation in 1994, the negotiations around that became part of South Africa's soft power of what it was trying to sell to the world as, you know, we are a nation born around human rights and negotiation. And that was a key part of their foreign policy objective. Obviously, debates about whether or not that ever actually really materialized. And certainly under more recent regimes under Zuma, but also under Ramaphosa, kind of big questions around whether or not, you know, does that sit at odds with a more pragmatic kind of nation state self-interest view of foreign policy? There's that side of the kind of wanting to export that soft power angle of what South Africa sees its foreign policy as being. And then the other one, of course, is that South Africa does have some kind of traditional ambition on the global stage. Within the United Nations, there has long been this debate around, you know, the expansion of the P5, the permanent five members of the United Nations Security Council. There are non-permanent members, of course, of which Kenya is currently one. And South Africa has held that non-permanent position, I think, three times now. You know, there's that kind of ambition as well of, well, OK, this, you know, this isn't just about South Africa having a position on Ukraine specifically, but it is about, you know, South Africa wanting to represent the continent and continental ambitions on a whole range of global issues. And so when something like this is the kind of center of global debate, it feels that it does need to have a position on it, because if it doesn't have a position on an issue like this that is so dominant within those international debates right now and within the UN, then it's difficult to justify having a greater role on other issues.
What is Putin's end game? Is he trying to resurrect the Soviet Union, or is he just trying to get NATO out of Ukraine because he thinks it's right on his border? Is there something that would persuade him to end this?
That's the golden question. And even reading from various Russia analysts, I don't think that there's a unified opinion of that. I know that we at Chatham House have got a collection of our Russia experts who are going to be doing an event on that specifically at some point this week. And so I'd advise people to go and watch that instead and hear those views. But I think that whatever his intention is, I think that it's not going to be one that South Africa can necessarily influence or impact. And so, you know, bringing it all the way back to Ramaphosa and Naledi Pandor and Derco and where South Africa sits in all of this, you know, it's that question of, you know, choose your alliances and position yourself. But there's not going to be a huge amount that they're going to be able to achieve. And certainly, you know, there's not a huge amount of domestic appetite here in South Africa for its leadership to be getting involved in kind of grand matters of global geopolitics right now. And that change of global thinking of how the country positions itself, you know, it's going to have to answer questions that it didn't necessarily want to answer. So, yeah.
So thank you so much, Chris Van Dam, a research fellow at Chatham House.
Hello, I'm Michael Apple. In this explainer, I'd like to break down the findings of a very important report that was recently released looking into the violent, destructive, and deadly riots that engulfed KwaZulu-Natal and parts of Gauteng in July last year. Timing is, of course, everything. Former President Jacob Zuma had just handed himself over to authorities to start serving a 15-month prison sentence for contempt of court when all hell broke loose in our country, wiping out 50 billion from our economy and killing over 350 people. This report focuses on the KwaZulu-Natal riots primarily, where roughly 80% of the looting and destruction was focused. Hearings by the South African Human Rights Commission's expert panel dealing with Gauteng are currently underway, but the KwaZulu-Natal report is likely to be the more significant of the two. I'm going to try to answer a few simple questions I'm sure we all have. What sparked the violence? Was it truly a spontaneous outpouring of rage caused by the incarceration of Zuma? Were the scenes of anarchy and destruction witnessed on our streets the culmination of infighting between different camps in the ANC? Were any rogue characters or units within the shadowy world of state security or crime intelligence loyal to the former president actively fueling the mayhem? Where on earth were the police or intelligence structures of the state? Could this have been avoided? In other words, were there warnings? Has our government learnt anything out of one of the most sordid periods in our democratic history? Can or might it happen again? Now, I thought I would have to answer these questions for you in a chronological order, but no, on the third page of the report, there's this, quote, "The looting, destruction and violence have come and gone, but we found that little has changed in the conditions that led to the unrest, leaving the public worried that there might be similar eruptions of large-scale unrest in future. The question, many argue, is not if and whether more unrest and violence will occur, but when it will occur," close quote. So that one's out the way. Off the bat, just so you're all aware, this expert panel that produced this report didn't have any powers of subpoena, so it couldn't summon anyone and it couldn't seize or demand any documentation. It relied on the goodwill and cooperation of those approached for information. So don't get this confused with a commission of inquiry, which has significantly greater powers of compulsion. So testimony before the expert panel wasn't in many cases backed up by documentary evidence. A lot of it was deemed classified and so never came before the panel. This expert panel took a look at the context in which this all unfolded, and these are important points. Think of these as the ingredients for chaos it identified. Weak state institutions hollowed out by almost a decade of state capture and repurposing for individual and party political gain. High unemployment, in fact, the highest youth unemployment in the world, about 75%. Mass poverty, and the highest level of inequality in the world. Rampant corruption in government. An anger fermenting in the population amidst growing frustration at COVID-19 restrictions. The report says all of these factors are themselves a recipe for constant instability in any country. The National Intelligence Coordination Committee, quite an unfortunate acronym, NICOC, warned government prior to 2021 that it needs to address the above-mentioned issues. But, quote, "It appeared not many members of the executive appreciated the meaning of the warnings raised in these reports and largely ignored them. The need to stop corruption in government and start addressing the needs of the people kept being kicked down the road, like a proverbial can," close quote. Interestingly, the panel found that the back and forth, the tit-for-tat battles between Zuma and the state capture inquiry over about an 8-month period was a major factor in the build-up to the violence and looting. Quote, "The incarceration of the former president at a correctional facility in Escort was the spark that ignited the orgy of violence," close quote. The day after Zuma is jailed, the 9th of July, a number of trucks are torched on the N3 highway. That's the arterial lifeblood linking KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. Attacks on shopping centers then followed. The report finds that there were elements of organization behind the looting, combined with normal opportunistic looting. Now, this is important. The planners wanted authorities to think it was spontaneous. The panel even coined a new phrase, organized spontaneity. The panel says that state security or crime intelligence made no intelligence products available to it. Intelligence products are just reports produced for a client, in this case the state. So state machinery wasn't playing open cards with the panel here. It says, quote, "What we can conclude is that the National Security Council as a structure does not seem to have received any clear, direct intelligence about the impending violence prior to it happening." Close quote. I just want to stop here for a second and refer to an extract from a book called 8 Days in July. It was written by journalists in the wake of the July riots and is based on leaked documents, intelligence briefs, and reports from across the state security cluster. So, documents the panel has never seen. In the conclusion of that book, it notes, quote, "Our investigation pointed to an intelligence alert on 11 May, 2 months before it kicked off, of the upheaval that was to come," close quote. But the authors also ask whether such a vague warning was enough to avert the crisis that unfolded. Evidently, the warning, arguably thin on detail, was ignored. As for the actions of the police once it had all kicked off, the panel finds there is no doubt that the police had insufficient capacity to stop the violence. There are 180,000 cops in this country. Obviously, not all of them are operational. And at the time the riots broke out, the public order policing unit of the SAPS numbered only 5,500, whereas the ideal operational strength required is over 12,700. The riots happened simultaneously in areas that are far from each other and took on a form of anarchy unfamiliar to even South Africa, that being the targeted looting and torching of shopping malls and warehouses. The failure of reliable intelligence points to the urgent need to implement the recommendations of the High-Level Review Panel on the State Security Agency. Now, that's a report commissioned by President Cyril Ramaphosa that found, in a nutshell, that the SSA, the State Security Agency, had been compromised by factionalism, mismanagement, and inefficiency. Actually, in the state capture inquiry, we heard how the SSA allegedly became a cash cow for Zuma, and how he created a parallel security regime loyal to him and effective in tackling his political enemies. The July riots expert panel finds there was a failure by the intelligence structures to anticipate and respond adequately to the violence. At this point, the report makes a general recommendation to security services. Use all lawful levers available to them, in particular the need to intercept communications in a lawful manner, where the security of the state is at stake. The State Security Agency says it provided all the necessary threat assessments and intelligence before, during, and after the crisis. The SSA says months prior to the Constitutional Court ruling sentencing Zuma to prison, it had reports, mobilization by groups in support of the former president with, quote, "possible imminent violence that could arise," close quote. But as I've mentioned before, this is simply their version. It's not necessarily backed by any documentation placed in the public domain. To add further confusion to this whole situation, on 8 July 2021, the day before the riots began, the Office of the Coordinator for Intelligence received a document from State Security categorically stating, quote, that no information had been identified suggesting that supporters of former President Zuma would gather and protest in a specific area in the province after the former president handed himself over to authorities in compliance with the warrant of his arrest as issued by the Constitutional Court on 29 June 2021, close quote. The panel doesn't know who authored or sent this report, but it came out right on the eve of the violence. It's fair to say it was hogwash. The report makes the finding that, quote, "the minister and the national commissioner are poles apart in their interpretation of how the events of July could have been managed. Close quote. Unbelievably, there was rank being thrown around on the ground between the SAPS and the South African National Defence Force, which was ultimately then deployed on the 12th of July. The report finds that SAPS initially excluded the SANDF from intelligence briefings. A colonel in the military was excluded from briefings due to his lower rank in comparison to his police counterparts. Quote, as a result, the SANDF was not clear as to where to deploy members. Close quote. Finally, the report finds that there has been a lack of adequate technological innovation and undercapacitation of the security services that ultimately hampered their efficient operations. Quote, much of the mobilization took place on cyber platforms, and the services had not been agile and aggressive enough in their modernization to keep up with this. Close quote. I don't know how you interpret this, but to me, this means police, intelligence, and state security agencies had no means by which to counter, infiltrate, or shut down the widespread use of WhatsApp groups and Twitter, used very successfully to incite and coordinate violent attacks. These riots are the most costly in our country's history. That's according to SASRIA, the South African Special Risk Insurance Association. Some 14,000 claims were submitted, totaling 30 billion rand in claims divided between KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng on an 80-20 split. Security experts and veterans of the intelligence community testified that it was obvious that the violence had been orchestrated, deliberate, and coordinated. These were not the actions of ordinary people. The ringleaders of the violence remain largely faceless. The president told the nation that they have identified 12 instigators who would be charged. But there's been a handful of individuals identified based on their inflammatory social media accounts, and they've been charged with nothing more than incitement to violence, finds the report. The mastermind, or masterminds, would be guilty of terrorist activity, from the methods used to loot and then destroy the logistics network between KZN and Gauteng, the report notes organized crime was likely involved. In essence, the panel says, cabinet must take overall responsibility for what unfolded. Intelligence structures failed completely to anticipate, prevent, or disrupt the planned and orchestrated violence. The police's response failed because it wasn't driven by any intelligence, and failed to adapt to the modus operandi on the ground. The soldiers who were deployed didn't know where to be deployed to make an impact, and they were not equipped to handle riot situations, but their show of force did restore calm. The internal differences within the governing party, the ANC, contributed to the unrest and should be addressed as a matter of national security now. Let that sink in, as it must for the ANC. Their internal squabbles for power and position are a threat to national security. Thanks for listening.
Nadja Swart for BizNews, and I'm chatting to Andrew Goodhead, who today finished his fifth day traveling our beautiful country. Andrew, you just showed me where you are. I was able to see the last little bit of a rainbow. Where are you today?
Hi, Nadia, and to all the listeners. I am about 20 Ks outside, I've forgotten the town's name. I've passed through so many towns.
I can imagine.
Wolfsburg is the town. And I'm not meant to be staying in Colesberg, but unfortunately, I had a mechanical this afternoon. My derailleur broke. So I had to MacGyver something on the bike, and the bike is now running single speed. But
can you explain to me what's the difference between single speed, double speed? What does the derailleur do?
The derailleur allows me to change gears. So a single speed is just set on one fixed gear. And if you're going up or downhill, you can't change. That's the simplest type of bicycle.
Okay.
And when a derailleur breaks, you do have the option to sort of open the chain and bypass the derailleur, which I did, which allowed me to sort of limp in to Colesberg. Interesting person here. He's offering me the night. And he is an ex-Free State pro cyclist.
Ah.
And so with one call, we managed to arrange a derailleur to be couriered to Colesberg tomorrow.
Okay, so tomorrow there'll be no travel?
There might be a little bit, half day, 100 Ks, depending on what time it comes.
Okay. We're going to be waiting for your arrival on Sunday. So you factored in an extra day for unforeseen mechanicals, just in case.
Yeah, kind of foreseen mechanicals.
Okay.
It's always, there's always something that goes wrong.
Okay. One would imagine.
Work at so I'm quite used to delays and cost runs.
So if you work in the industry, is that how you know Solar Saver? Because they are sponsoring you.
Absolutely. So they've been very generous. I work as a civil engineer and I spend a lot of time doing roof inspections for Solar Saver. And that actually prompted the idea of doing a solar-powered cycle through South Africa. I look at a lot of roofs and assess their potential to install solar panels all over the country, from Upington, Cape Town, KZN, all over the place, all different types of industries. And I thought, would it be possible to put these things on a bicycle?
So this has never been done before.
At the moment, as with all ideas, when you think of the idea and you think it's novel, you do a quick Google search and find that someone else has already done it. But I think it's the first time in South Africa. Yes.
So
someone
cool.
else has beat me to it.
Oh, but not yet. I mean, and we're very backwards anyway. So how many kilometers do you have left?
I've got 700, which sounds like a lot, but when the bike's working well, which I expect it to be, I can do sort of 230 a day. So that's 3 days, three, 4 days. Yes. So I should be rolling in a day later, Monday evening, Tuesday morning. That's the new plan.
Well, that's just in time. That's when the conference starts.
Always just in time.
I'm Linda Contorberg for BizNews. The Chairman of Motorsport South Africa, Anton Roux, has been appointed as a member of the Senate of the International Motorsport Body that Motorsport SA falls under, the FIA or Fédération Internationale de l'Automobile. And joining us now in our virtual studio is Anton Roux. He is a boardroom veteran and he was also the former CEO of Aeon Africa and Metzky. Hi, Anton. Congratulations. And what does this all mean?
First of all, I think we've got to take one step back in that John Todt came to the end of his 12-year term at the FIA as president. And John has done a superb job over the last 12 years. And then we had an election for a new president in December last year. And Mohammed bin Sulayman from the UAE was elected as the president of the FIA. And it's not that he didn't have any opposition. There was another gentleman who opposed him. But anyway, Mohammed is a esteemed motorsport fanatic, also a competitor in cross-country events around the world. And he became the president. And I think as one would expect, there's obviously some changes in the FIA with a new leader up front, where I think he wants to focus definitely a lot more on making motor racing more affordable and more accessible, and also expand motorsport in some of the parts of the world, such as the East, as well as bringing the USA closer to the FIA. The FIA consists basically of two legs. The one is motorsport, which is 85% of the business, and the other 15% is mobility. And mobility in South African terms is things like the Automobile Association and road safety. There are three governing bodies within the FIA. The one focuses on motorsport, the other one on mobility, and then there's the Senate. And the Senate consists of 16 members, which is the overall body looking after governance and finance within the FIA, and I've been appointed as a Senate member to the FIA last week.
Motorsport is seen to be an elitist sport. What is going on in South Africa? How has it changed? How has it become more inclusive? And how has the pandemic affected you?
We've had two horrible years, 20 and 21. But if I go back to 2019, we've hosted around about 450 events a year in South Africa. It then dropped down in 20. Last year, we were just short of 300 events. And this year, again, we aim to host BBEV back up and host another 450 events. So motorsport is certainly active, very alive. Every person focuses obviously on the area of motorsport that they're familiar with. If it's track racing, you'll be track racing. Or if it's motorbikes, you'll look at motorbikes or karting and karting. But there's all in all, there's 12 different categories of motorsport taking place. And if I look at our January license renewals, we have seen a 20% increase in the number of competitors versus last year, which is actually quite significant, which is not yet taking us back to the 2019 level, but I'm confident that we're going to get there. So motorsport alive and very well. You know, it's one of the sporting bodies that has never in its history had a qualified audit report. The governance is good. And, you know, South Africa is sitting with 67 competitors at the moment that's competing internationally.
Well, I've noted that a South African engineer has joined the Mercedes Formula One team. Is South African motorsport becoming more accessible? Are there new people being enthusiastic about it and interested in the sport?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fantastic that he got appointed by the Mercedes-Benz Formula One team. There is already another South African in there, also a graduate from UCT that's working in the team. But not to detract from that, the Mercedes-Benz Formula One team employ 1,800 people. So, you know, it's not the 30 people that you see on a weekend. There's a whole 1,800 of them making two cars go fast.
Well, talking about Mercedes, can we ask you to dive in about the controversy last year with the Formula One championship between Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen?
Look, having sat in motor in race control in a number of events in my life, and never in a Formula One event, I think one first of all must understand the pressure that there is in race control at an event, and that sometimes you're going to have things that occur which is not in any rule book. So I'll give you an example. In January this year, we had a 9-hour event at Kyalami, which was an international event, on the Saturday. And on the Friday afternoon before that, we had a 1-hour race of South African cars. And we've had a ginormous thunderstorm on the Friday afternoon, 10 minutes into this race. We lost radio communication with all the marshals and the safety car. We then lost our backup WhatsApp group communication with all the corners. And then even telephone calls couldn't be made. And we eventually decided to red flag a race, even though there was no incident on the circuit. So your rule book's also not going to deal with a situation like this. But it's fairly tense because the competitors, the participants obviously came off and said, well, it was raining, but what went on? Why did you stop the race? We couldn't see anything. We didn't stop it with the safety car because we couldn't tell the safety car to go out, you know. So coming back to the last event, I think the solution that's being proposed right now is a correct one, where we will have more than one race director that will alternate one another. So hopefully we can also, there's a bit of separation of duties, but at the same time, you know, the accusation that one of them is favoring a specific team will be removed. Plus then, what we are doing, and we've learned a lot from how FIFA does it, we are building a backup control room where, if I can call it as such, your television referee would be based. And they won't be at the circuit. So it's a permanent location that will be permanently staffed by the same people handling all the Formula One events. And then, obviously, during a race, it gives the race director, who is still in charge, then the opportunity to refer certain items back to your television race directors, who's then got the ability to fast forward, rewind, go in slow motion, and have a look a little bit more what's happening. So I think we're going to end up with a better result. I certainly hope so.
So it's like introducing a third umpire, like in cricket.
The problem with a motorsport event is you can't stop it to go look at the footage.
Right.
You know, the event's going to carry on, you know. So that's why we're actually going. And it's a very big cost to the FIA, not only the equipment, but also the communication, which will have to be in real time so that they've got the ability to go and look at it from various angles, listen to the communication as well. I think the other improvement is also, I think, where the teams had the ability to communicate with the race directly, I think it made for interesting television, but it certainly detracted or took the focus away from what the race director was busy with at the time when you have a Christian Horner or a Toto Wolff trying to talk to you at the same time.
Yeah.
And also just bearing in mind, you know, if you watch Sky, or, you know, which is the feed we get in South Africa, you're only going to get selected communication. We heard two of them, you know, we've heard Christian Horner and we've heard Toto Wolff, but there's eight other teams also talking, which you don't necessarily see in the television.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to get distracted. So we've put a mechanism in place as well that there can be communication to race control, but not directly to the race director.
You mentioned Kyalami. Is that now owned by Porsche?
So Kyalami was bought a couple of years ago, not by Porsche, but by Toby Venter. And Toby is also the owner of Porsche South Africa. He spent over 200 million rand in acquiring the circuit, and then he spent over another 300 million rand upgrading the facility. So we really have an absolute world-class facility on our doorstep between Johannesburg and Pretoria that is ready to host the Formula One event. There's a little bit of minor changes that need to be made to the circuit, but obviously those changes will only be made if there's a definite secure date for the event.
So Anton, are you on a mission to bring Formula One back to Kyalami?
Well, I think one of the things that I've always been saying is, guys, you can't have a world championship and then just skip the entire continent. So I think if you look at it, where in Africa can you have an event? The one which is a circuit that is ready and can host it with the infrastructure around it and is hosting international events is Kyalami.
Nice.
I think from time to time there's movements of people saying, well, let's do a street circuit in Cape Town. That's a possibility, but it's incredibly expensive. Also very, very disruptive to the people of Cape Town. But there will be a Formula E event in Cape Town, which will be a street circuit event. And it's obviously much smaller than Formula One. But just for that one, you know, the cost of the putting up a circuit for, let's say, a week is in excess of 40 million rand. So it's really, really large sums of money.
So can we hope it will come back?
I think we can certainly hope so. We can certainly. We're working hard. I think, you know, you obviously got to get government buy-in to be able to do this. And, you know, you mentioned the word earlier on that it's an elitist sport.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and no. If I look at what's happening in karting at the moment, around about half our participants in karting event of the young kids under the age of 12 are non-white.
Oh, wow.
So certainly, you know, I'm going to struggle if you talk about historic racing cars or cars that raced in the 70s and the 80s to find black people to participate in that because they never participated during those times. So the appeal to them is not necessarily there. However, the appeal is certainly there in the younger classes, you know, looking at karting and then things like Polo Cup. So I don't necessarily think that it is an expensive sport, but whether it's elitist, I don't know. But obviously the feasibility study on a Formula One event is much wider than just the cost of the event. You know, we've seen with World Cups and rugby and football what it can do to the psyche of the country, what it can do to promote South Africa. And you know me, I've always maintained that South Africa needs a new PR agency. We really need one. I mean, if I look at some of the stuff that we are known for, it's really all the bad stuff. And if I go back to a feasibility study that was done in the 90s, even at that time, just the VAT that we would be paid by the tourists and the teams coming to South Africa was bigger than the guarantee that's required from government. So it's certainly financially beneficial, And if you look at Formula One spectator numbers around the world, 60% of all the people going to a Formula One event is always a foreigner. So if you look at Silverstone in the UK, 60% of the people are not from the UK. And that's sort of what you see all around the world. We also see massive traction in the US beginning to follow Formula One with the Formula One event in Texas, as well as one scheduled for this year in Miami. But you know, the Texas Grand Prix last year had more spectators than the Olympic Games. There were 380,000 spectators over the 3 days at the Circuit of the Americas, which is just unbelievable. And that's why there's a second event in Miami. I think what's contributed massively to the Formula One following as well is Netflix and the Drive to Survive series.
Yeah.
Because from the limited numbers that I've seen, it would seem that we're picking up new spectators, people who didn't watch the sport beforehand, big growth amongst teenage girls. Now, they're not necessarily watching because they support Ferrari or McLaren or Red Bull. They support it because they think Lando Norris is cute, you know, or they like George Russell. Certainly, I think there's a lot more females following the sport as a consequence of the Drive to Survive series. And on the 11th of March, Netflix is launching the next series of Drive to Survive based upon last year. So, yeah, we're hopeful.
So are you lobbying the government to get their stamp of approval?
I think there's also, it's important to note that there's a whole number of people involved in organizing events. You've clearly got the Formula One events holder, Worldwide Liberty, owning the rights to host the event. Then there's the FIA. You then have Motorsport South Africa, who's affiliated to the FIA. Then your global promoter will need to appoint a South African promoter to host the event. Mm-hmm. So, and then you've got the government. So it's not just that you can make a call to one entity and you've got an event arranged. You've got to coordinate it between four difficult institutions. Then there's obviously the financial impact study, and then there's obviously the time to secure a date and to find an appropriate date. The only definitive answer is that South Africa won't have a Formula One event in 2022. But, you know, the soonest that we can hope for to get onto the calendar might be in 2023.
Anton, you spoke about the importance of inclusivity, and you said the FIA's new chairperson also wants that. Are you thinking of including sports like car spinning that is so popular in the townships under Motorsport SA?
So spinning is a delicate one from the point of view is that we would like to include them, and we've had numerous discussions with them. But, you know, from our side, they must first get themselves organized. You know, there's various spinning bodies, and they normally, at this moment in time, they are all somehow associated with one specific venue. So you may have two venues in Johannesburg, and one group of people spin at the one venue and the other group of people spin at the other venue. And then there's competition amongst them. And we say to them, get yourself organized. Get yourself organized into a structure that we can talk to you on a national level. But certainly the crowd loves it. But, I mean, there's some serious safety challenges.
Yeah.
You know, and I think safety of motorsport is paramount for us. So, that's a bit of a challenge. But we're certainly in discussions with them. Just on the gender matter, in 2019 at the FIA conference, we did a bit of a study to see how many female participants are around the world. And 8% of license holders in South Africa are females. And that's one of the highest numbers in the world. So that was very encouraging.
Anton Roux, the chairman of Motorsport SA, who now also sits on the Senate of the FIA, congratulations and thank you for speaking to us. And we're all hoping that Formula One would come back to Kyalami.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Linda.
Today is Monday, February 28th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Over the weekend, we saw tougher government sanctions on Moscow and a stunning corporate move to divest from Russia after it invaded Ukraine. We'll also talk with the FT's John Thornhill about what this invasion says about the limits of Russia's cyber warfare.
Cyber weapons can amplify or complement other forms of power, but they are not a substitute for them. They can't achieve things on their own. So I think hard power still counts.
I'm Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need. The world's biggest sovereign wealth investor, Norway's oil fund, has been instructed to freeze all new investments in Russia immediately. It'll also start unwinding its existing $3 billion worth of Russian holdings. This is part of a wider package of support for Ukraine. And in the UK, oil major BP announced that it will divest its 20% stake in Russian state oil company Rosneft. We spoke to the FT's Tom Wilson about that.
This move is absolutely huge. And if you'd asked me 3 days ago, completely unexpected. BP's been in Russia for 30 years and it's held this stake in Rosneft for almost a decade. Up until very, very recently, when you would ask BP about its Rosneft stake, which has always been contentious, BP would say that they're in Russia for business, not for politics. But really, in the last 4 days, when we've seen the brutality of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, on Friday, we reported that Chief Executive Bernard Looney had been called in to see a senior British cabinet member who expressed his unease with BP's stake in the business. And then 48 hours later, we've got this announcement.
So, Tom, how exactly will BP go about divesting its stake?
That's going to be very difficult. What BP said yesterday was that it was planning to divest, but it didn't specify how or when it might do that. And as I said, they've really got three options. They can either write off the shareholding completely and walk away. They could try and sell it back to Rosneft, which they might do. And if Rosneft agreed, they would pay a huge discount. Or thirdly, they might try and find another buyer. So when I speak to people in the industry, they've speculated that the only entities that might be interested in taking a stake with Rosneft, given all that geopolitical risk and the optics, might be an East Asian parastatal or potentially a Middle Eastern group. But there aren't any easy options.
Is this expected to hurt Rosneft?
So short term, the immediate impact on Rosneft is not significant. BP was a 20% shareholder, but a minority shareholder. It was a passive shareholder. So they weren't actually collaborating together on specific projects. So Rosneft can continue to pump oil from its oil projects and continue to sell that oil on the international market. So it doesn't hurt immediately, but long term, it does huge damage to Rosneft's reputation as a viable partner for international companies. And Rosneft has a whole series of other relationships and joint ventures with other Western entities. And those relationships are now going to come under huge scrutiny. So we'll see what happens in the following days and whether other companies like the oil traders Trafigura and Vitol, who both have joint ventures with Rosneft in the Russian Arctic. We'll see how they respond to BP's decision, whether they do something similar.
Tom Wilson is the FT's senior energy correspondent. In another important response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the U.S. and Western allies unveiled tough financial sanctions. The EU said it will expel some Russian banks from the major international bank payments network called SWIFT, and the U.S. and European allies announced plans to block Russia's central bank from using its foreign reserves. This would hurt Moscow's ability to shore up its economy and prevent Moscow from getting around existing sanctions. Here's our U.S. economics editor, Colby Smith, with more.
So the aim of these sanctions is to really cut off the country from the global financial system and to make it almost impossible for the country to also support its currency. So what these sanctions do, they really undermine the ability of Russia to circumvent some of the sanctions that have already been put in place against some of the biggest banks and other leadership. So it's a really important moment in the U.S. and Western alliances' response to this crisis.
So, Colby, how would Russia have circumvented some of the sanctions already in place? And how does this move against the central bank prevent that?
One tactic is Russia could have used its roughly $630 billion stockpile of foreign reserves. And essentially, those reserves could have been used to support the economy and shield it from some of the costs associated with the sanctions. So essentially, if there was, let's say, downward pressure on the currency, which we've seen, the central bank could, you know, use its reserves in order to prop up the ruble. And now what these sanctions essentially do is it prevents the central bank from easily being able to do this. One important counterpoint is the fact that the country has a very high current account surplus that's been amassed due to significant energy exports. So that's going to provide it some protection. But Russia's central bank is going to be quite hamstrung by these new restrictions.
Has Russia responded at all to this, Colby?
So we don't know the kind of full financial fallout from these sanctions, and we might get a better sense when we see trading resume on Monday. But the central bank has sought to quell any kind of financial panic and have said, you know, they have sufficient resources to ensure that they can support the currency and ensure that there isn't a destabilizing run on the banks. That's the real impact here, is what this more broadly means for Russia's financial system and the economy as a whole.
Colby Smith is the FT's U.S. economics editor. Thanks, Colby.
Thank you.
Shares in cybersecurity companies like CrowdStrike and Cloudflare jumped last week as companies around the world rushed to boost their cyber defenses. Spurring this was the discovery in Ukraine of a wiper malware, a kind of cyber weapon that permanently deletes data on infected computers. Now, Ukraine has long been one of Russia's top targets for cyber attacks, part of Moscow's effort to undermine Ukraine. But the FT's John Thornhill says the current military invasion speaks to the limits of cyber warfare. He joins me now to talk more about this. Hey, John.
Hi there, Mark.
So, John, in addition to being our current innovation editor, you are our former FT Moscow bureau chief. So you have an idea of what has happened in the past when it comes to Russia and cyber warfare. Can you walk me through that?
Yes. Yeah, so I was actually in Russia in the 1990s. I was there for 6 years. And I left pretty much when Putin came to power. And I had an interview with Putin in 1999 when he was prime minister taking over. And I mean, how he has developed over the past 20 years is extraordinary. When he came in, he was very much, he styled himself as a westernizing figure. He talked about how Russia's mission was to be part of Europe and the broader world. And he's come on a very long journey since then. One of the things that he has really focused on is cyber as a means of projecting power. That I think he thinks that there is an asymmetry in power in the world. Russia is still a relatively small economy, certainly compared to America and the rest of Europe. But cyber does give him asymmetrical power, which is why the Russians have spent a lot of money investing in their cyber capabilities, and both offensive and defensive.
So, John, if Putin puts so much stock in a cyber warfare approach, why are we seeing a military approach right now when it comes to Ukraine?
I think that's a fascinating thing. I mean, Russia has effectively been waging cyber war against Ukraine since 2014 after the Maidan Revolution and Viktor Yanukovych got thrown out. And they have deployed all of the Russian arsenal of cyber weapons against Ukraine. But I think in a way it highlights the limitations of cyber power. I mean, it has been incredibly effective in some senses in taking down kind of airports or banks or government ministries temporarily. But the Ukrainian system has been relatively resilient and it hasn't achieved Putin's strategic goals, which are to kind of undermine Ukraine and to change the course of its politics. So I think the fact that Putin has now decided to send in military force shows that cyber weapons can amplify or complement other forms of power, but they are not a substitute for them. They can't achieve things on their own. So I think hard power still counts.
So what could cyber warfare's role be in this ongoing conflict in Ukraine, and as well as when the international community gets more involved?
I think the honest answer to that is no one has a clue. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of experts on cyber who think there is a certain pattern that this will follow, which is namely that both sides are going to be quite wary of doing anything terrible to the other because of fear of what the other side can do. But given that we are now in a pretty open conflict situation, think it's extraordinarily difficult to predict in which way this is going to go. So I think it's going to be very intriguing to see how this plays out.
John Thornhill is our former Moscow bureau chief and our current innovation editor. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Mark.
You can read more on all of these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
That's it from the Biz News team this hour. Join us again tomorrow for your Power Hour.